18 months ago, I met Groucho in New York. I followed him around, watched him at work, at play, and with his family. Recently, he came to London for a television show. On his arrival, he gave a press conference, and for 90 minutes, he was questioned by newspaper men. His replies prove that Groucho Marx is still king of the ad-lib, master of the spontaneous laugh line. Some of these replies I have chosen for this program, and the first is right on his beam. The subject is the American personality, Zsa Gabor.
I did a show and Zsa Zsa was on the show. Now that's a name that doesn't require a last name anymore. It's like Shaw or Shakespeare. And one of the questions asked was, could you love a man if you didn't have any money? And she stood up and she said, oh yes, I could love a man if he didn't have any money, didn't have any jewels, didn't have any possessions of any kind. If I loved him, I would marry him if he had nothing. She sat down and I stood up and I said, Zsa Zsa, that's the finest piece of fiction since The Tale of Two Cities.
They asked him about women drivers.
Women are much better drivers. And I'll tell you why. It's because when a woman is driving, she looks straight ahead. The man is looking on every corner and see if there's a dame there that looks attractive.
Don't the women look to see if the men are attractive?
No. Most of the attractive men are in automobiles.
Groucho, you are irresistible, a girl reporter tells him. Did his pictures attract women?
Most women don't understand humor. Now, this is true. Crazy humor I'm talking about. Like Stephen Leacock, or I'm talking about the average woman. They don't dig humor. They don't. You know, the Chaplin was never a big draw to the women? I mean, he was certainly the greatest comedian, certainly in our, in the last 200 years. I don't go back further than that. There's never anybody like him. But he wasn't a big draw to the women. And this was true of Benchley and Stephen Leacock and Donald Ogden Stewart and Sid Feraman and all the humorous writers today. They get a male audience. And that's why a lot of women went to see the later pictures, because it had this hokey love story. And who didn't go to see the duck suit and horse feathers and monkey business and those pictures? They were too nutty. They didn't dig them.
It's women again. On the screen, he was told, you were never smooth like a Casanova. You always rushed things.
Is that my normal attitude towards women? Just the opposite. Unfortunately, I think that's what women like. I think I should have used my stage attitude in my private life. I think I would have had many more responses. Affirmative ones, I mean. But I think women get bored with the preliminaries in most cases. Well, I don't mean you shouldn't send them two roses or something like that. But I think too much dickering, too much fooling around. I think a woman says, oh, come off it, you know. Let's get on with it, huh?
The question he is always being asked comes up. Did you ever yearn to go serious and play Shakespeare?
Like Othello? I got a book from Lawrence Olivier in the States when he was over there. And he had written in the beginning, to the entertainer, from the entertainer. You know, he had done that picture. I was quite proud of him. Nice fellow. So now I have to go see him in my plays. And it's really not my cup of tea, but it's worthwhile to see him. Well, I like to go to the theater here. The theaters are small. I like it here very much. And you can get a drink in the back of the house. And if the show is lousy, you can get drunk while the show is on. And as a matter of fact, one of the best meals I ever had was doing at the Mission at the Palladium some years ago. This is true. And those wonderful sandwiches and beer. And it's just great. Didn't have to watch any of the acts.
The Alhambra used to have a barbershop.
No, I never drank any of that.
Then the same question I put to him in America. Critics say his films have social meaning, significance. Is that true?
Not at all. I think that's one of the phoniest kind of phony devices that some writers use. They're not satisfied just to see something funny. They have to see significance in it. And we had never planned on having any significance in anything we ever did. We were just trying to make the audience laugh. And I remember there was a show in New York open called Bandwagon. This was a musical with Frank Morgan, and the Astaires were in there. And Frank Morgan came out before the curtain, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I know there's a lot of plays in New York with social significance. Don't regard this as one of them. All we're going to try to do here is to make a little money." There was one fellow, he was a wonderful writer. The day after we opened in Animal Crackers on Broadway, he wrote a piece mostly about me, in which he said that I was the embodiment of the Jewish oppression that had gone on for 2,000 years. It was the goddamnedest kind of reviewing. As I said, all we were trying to do was be funny, and he had everything in there. He had hunks of the Bible in there and everything. Now, we were astonished by this. Later, I had somebody explain it to me, but we didn't understand it at all. But people do that. They review books, too, sometimes, which are just meant to be comic or funny, and they see all kinds of things in that that really don't exist except in their own minds. But everybody makes a living in a different way. This is one way that they depart from the traditional or the orthodox. Can you use the word orthodox here?
Whenever Groucho is seen, he is chewing at a yardstick of a cigar. Smoking a cigar generally makes a man look solid and dependable. Yet Groucho is reported to be a very insecure person. Is this true?
Well, I think everybody is insecure. I don't mean only in show business, I mean in every business. If you think at all, you have to think that someday you're going to get older and your earning power will decrease. This isn't very funny, it's factual, but it's true. I don't think any insecurity is just revolves around anybody in show business, although I do believe it's one of the more precarious professions financially. You know, you can be a star one day and a bum the next day. Public favor changes very swiftly. But we were doing Day at the Races. I had gotten wiped out in 1929 in the market crash, and this was shortly after this. I didn't have any. I had $25,000. Which isn't a lot of money for an actor. You know, you depend strictly on the favor of the audience. It was a scene in a sanitarium, and there were 12 kind of elderly women sitting there. And Sam Wood, the director, came over to me and he says, "Groucho, you see those women? 9 of those 12 women were earning $15,000 or $2,000 a week 15 years ago. They had been stars or pretty big names. And this scared the hell out of me. I called up an insurance agent, and I said, I'd like to get an insurance policy where I'll have $80 a week for the rest of my life. Because I always was scared that maybe someday I'd be an extra waiting in line to get a job for $10 a day, $8 a day. So I bought this insurance policy for $25,000, all the money I had. But it gave me a great feeling of independence after that. And I'm sure many of the contracts that we subsequently made, we got much more money than we should have because I always had that $80 a week waiting for me. Unfortunately, when the policy became due, I had made so much money by that time on TV and in the movies that I didn't need it. And when I went to cash it in, the government took most of it in taxes.
What were his plans for the future?
I'd stay alive for a number of years. I'm going to do a show next year. There's a show called the Patty Duke Show over there. And I'm going to do a show with them. It's a family show, but I'm dead. I'm a ghost. And I come back each week and advise the family about their lives and affairs. Just the problems that they have. And I'm sure that everything I tell them will turn out wrong. And it's a very funny idea for me. It doesn't require too much work because I'm a ghost and I just wear a diaphanous outfit at some time. Sexy, I imagine. I imagine they have sexy ghosts wherever the ghosts congregate. No reason why they shouldn't. I've never had a ghost writer, though.
He seemed terribly keen to visit Ireland. Was there a Colleen on his mind?
I'm coming back in September, and I'm going to Ireland. But I don't want to go to Dublin. I want to go out in the country. See the countryside. You see, I did a picture with Maureen O'Sullivan called Day of the Races, and she always used to talk to me about Ireland. I was madly in love with her one time when we did Day of the Races, until the day the picture was finished. I never saw her again. I saw her many years later. By this time, she had 7 children. That was the end of romance.
There'd been several hints about romantic escapades. Why didn't he put them down in a book?
I've written 4 books. I had one out about 6 months ago called Memoirs of a Mangy Lover. Wasn't it published over here? That's the only thing that ever nettled me. When people say, who wrote the books for you? The trouble with writing a book, unless you're Chaucer or Hemingway or Sinclair Lewis or somebody like that, you have to plug the book, which means you have to go on any number of shows. Like you have to go on The Tonight Show, The Today Show, The Steve Allen Show. You have to go on all these shows for practically nothing. I hate to go on all these shows. It's kind of embarrassing to sit and talk about your own book. And as a rule, the people who operate the show haven't read the books. They quickly read a chapter or something, and they confine you to this. So by the time you go on all these shows for nothing, if you made any money on the book, you would lose money. But I don't mind that. I've given the proceeds of all my books to charity. Say charity begins at home, but it didn't in my case. I always gave the money away. I give it to hospitals because they have a rough time in order for them to have any charity patients at all. They need an enormous amount of money. It's tough for them. And if you've ever been in a hospital in the United States, it's terribly expensive. The average person can't even go there. They have to go to free clinics. I believe in Medicare. I think we're going to have it in America. I think we should have it. It's done a great deal for this country, I think. I know when I first came over here, almost everybody didn't have any teeth. And I'm not joking. And now everybody has teeth over here. And I think that's a tremendous advance.
Going back to the theater, was it true that in the old days of vaudeville, a theater manager could fine an actor on the spot?
Before there was an actor's equity and before we had the union organization. There was a song called When I Woke Up This Morning, She Was Gone. I don't know whether you ever heard that song. It was very popular in America about 40 years ago, and we were playing in vaudeville, and we had a scene where I was playing a real old man with snow white hair. And the first act was a school act, and then it was 10 years later. In the first act, I looked 21, and the second act, I looked 90. But it was the only wig I could find, and it was snow white. And I should have looked 35 in the second act. At any rate, I made this long, dreary, sentimental speech, and at the finish, for no reason at all, I said, and then when I woke up this morning, she was gone. And the manager rushed backstage and says, that'll cost you $10. And I said to him, it was worth $10. In those days, they were able to find you. I was playing with a dancing act in Denver, Colorado once. We had a tap dancer in our act, and his shoes were too loose. One of his shoes, a wooden shoe, flew off into the audience and hit somebody. We were getting $100 for the act, and we were fined $40 for that. So we wound up with $60.
Was Groucho going highbrow on us? He recently wrote an introduction to a book on art.
There's a man named Searle, Ronald Searle, that I'm crazy about. And I don't know anything about art. But last week, the Random House was publishing a new book of his. And his stuff runs on holiday in the States. He does wonderful stuff. And they wrote me if I would write an introduction to the book. And I said, you're never going to meet anybody that knows less about art than I do. I'm not qualified to write this. There are many men in America who could do a great job on that. So they wrote me back and asked me if I'd write anything. I said, I think he's wonderful. I said, I don't know anything about art. I know that Beethoven was a great painter. And There was another chap who walked around on his knees for many years in Paris. And a couple of crazy remarks like that. And they sent me $250. So you see, you really don't have to know anything about a subject in order to make money.
Did he find the name Groucho in a book somewhere? How did he and his brothers dream up their names?
Well, there used to be a cartoon run on the paper many years ago. It was called Groucho the Monk. And somebody tagged this title on me. And Harper's name is obvious. Comes from the heart. Chico's name. Fellas who used to chase girls were called chicken chasers years ago. You know, comes from girl was a chick. Gummo's name comes from the fact that when he was around 12 years old, somebody had given him a pair of rubbers. They were called gumshoes in those days. And he was so delighted with these, liked them so much, he would only wear them when the sun was shining. He didn't want to get them wet. That's where his name comes from. Zeppo's name comes from the fact that he was born the day the first Zeppelin landed in America from Germany. So it gives you an idea how silly all these names actually are. But they were good names for show business. It was better than our real names, anyhow. My name is Julius, and Harper was Arthur. Chico was Leo. Zeppo was Herbert. And Gummo was Milton. So you see, these are an improvement.
Now he is questioned about the free, uninhibited days of the 20s.
Don't you know in America years ago, when prostitution was legal, the madams of the various houses in a town like Atlanta or Montgomery, Alabama, Birmingham, New Orleans, they would come to the opening show. They would sit in the boxes, representative of the various houses. The madams would be there with their girls. And if they liked the act, you would get notes backstage. You'd come down and visit them after the show. All comparatively young people who were single accepted these invitations. It was nothing was thought of it either. I could tell you a wonderfully grim story about Harper. We were in a house in, I think it was in Birmingham. And there was a whole gang of us. And Harper was kidding with one girl. And Harper's, he's the most wonderful brother of all the brothers. The most gentle and the nicest. And the kindest in every way. We're all crazy about Harper, but he was in some kind of a mood that night. And he was kidding this girl, not harmfully, but for some curious reason, she took offense at this. So we started to leave around 1 o'clock, and the girl came to Harper and said, I like you, and would you like to stay at Harper? He said, sure, Harper's 18 or 19. So she took him upstairs on the first floor, opened the door of her room, put him in there. And he heard the lock click. And he was in this room. There was a cot in the room, an army cot, and a kind of an old broken down dresser. So he kept waiting for this girl to come in, and she didn't come in. It got to be 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. Finally, you heard squeals, squeaking, coming from the side of the floor. And he looked over there, and there were two big rats there. And Harper scared them away. And apparently they liked this, and they came back again and brought a couple more with them. Well, he was terrified. And he told me he was never so frightened in his life. Around 5 o'clock, he heard the click in the door. And the door opened. And he ran outside. And as he got outside, there were 6 girls upstairs on the first floor laughing hysterically with their heads out the window as Harper scampered back to the hotel. Isn't that a real de Maupassant story?
A woman reporter wanted to know the history of his moustache. How did it become his trademark?
I tell you what happened. I had worn this moustache early in vaudeville. And we had played the Palace, and the following week we were playing the Fifth Avenue Theater on 29th Street. And at the Palace we did 2 shows a day, and here we did 4. And since our act ran an hour, I was on the stage about 4 hours a day. So we would give a show around 2 o'clock and then give one at 5, and then you gave one at 8. So if we went on at 5, we were through at 6, and then we'd have to eat pretty quickly in order to get back for the next show. And I got back, we were fooling around the restaurant or something, I got back for the next show just as our curtain music was being played, and I didn't have time to paste on a mustache, which I was doing then, so there was some black grease paint there, and I just took it and went like that. And I noticed that the laughs were in the same place. What wasn't funny didn't get a laugh. What was funny got the same laugh. So I said, what the hell am I gluing that thing on every show? So then when we started to do the first picture, which was Coconuts, Walter Wanger, I think, was the head of Paramount then. And he says, of course, you're going to use a real mustache here. And I said, why? He says, well, in a movie, nobody walks around with a painted mustache. Everybody has a real mustache or they glue one on. I says, well, I don't think that makes much sense either. Our pictures didn't make much sense, and I don't see why I have to have a glued mustache on when I could paint one on. He says, well, the audience won't believe you're real. Oh, I forgot to tell you. Down at the Fifth Avenue Theater, when I did this, when I come off the stage, the manager said, you played the Palace last week, and you glued on a mustache, and we're paying you the same money they paid you. And he said, I want the same mustache. So we told him to get the hell out of the room, and that was the end of the day. He didn't bother us anymore. Now, since Walter Wanger, we had a big discussion with him. He says, I want the real mustache. I says, well, look, let's take a short scene out of the play, and we'll do it. There's a scene I did with Chico. It lasted about 3 minutes, and I painted it on, and we had people in the audience. And they laughed at the same spot. And I says, now you're satisfied. He says, okay, paint it on. Now, in the last part of the picture, there was a scene where I turned and spoke to the camera and spoke to the audience. I don't remember exactly what it was. I said something about, look, you don't have to sit here if you don't like it. There's popcorn in the lobby, and go out in the lobby. And the Wanger said, well, you can't do that. I said, why not? He says, well, you're out of the picture if you do that. He says, well, strange interlude with Eugene O'Neill. He did it on the stage. And he said something to this woman, and he talked to the audience. He says, yeah, I know, but the stage and the movies are different. So we argued about it, but that was the end of it. I spoke in 3 or 4 movies after that, and now I see a lot of people do it in the movies. So you see, I have shattered some precedents.
The international joker, Groucho Marx, eternal gag man with a stoop and a cigar, began his press conference with a story about an actress, and ends with one. Subject, Greta Garbo.
When we were playing at MGM, she was the biggest female star in the whole world. Everybody was terrified of this woman. For no reason, not because of her, because she was very nice. This legend that she always wanted to be alone. She affected very curious outfits, and one day she came into the elevator. I was in the elevator, and she had on a flat hat, like the old-fashioned Merry Widow hat. I didn't know who she was. She backed into the elevator, and I took the back part of the hat for want of something to do and pushed it up, and the whole front came down. And I turned around, and it was Garbo. And I said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. I thought you were a fella I knew from Kansas City.
That recording of replies made by Groucho Marx at a press conference was broadcast by courtesy of Rediffusion, London.